www.lifeonearth.org.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Well, tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock, we'll hear a special production of the NPR program, Tell Me More. The national broadcast will originate from WLRN. And with us now is Tell Me More host Michelle Martin, who'll be heading our way shortly for tomorrow's program. She joins us now from NPR in Washington. Welcome to you, Michelle Martin. It's a great pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
So give us a heads up on this special education program of Tell Me More, which airs tomorrow at 11.
Well, we're excited about it. Very excited to be coming to see you, Joseph, and the other folks at WLRN. I hope you'll have some key lime pie for us.
Oh, key lime pie, sure.
Or something.
And stone crabs.
And stone crabs, yes. Well, we're excited about it because education has been one of the pillars of this program since we started a little over 5 years ago. I mean, it was one of those things that, you know, we all talk about whether you have, well, obviously most often if you have kids who are still in school or if you are thinking about having kids, you know, education is one of the biggest expenses that families have, higher education in particular. It can determine where people live. I mean, you know that people who have the means to do so often look for houses in excellent school districts. It's just a major source of anxiety and concern for people, and certainly also for employers. I mean, even if you don't have kids in the school system, if you're in a position to hire people, you're concerned. If kids, do they have what they need to function, you know, in your business or in your organization? So it's a major concern of people, but it's one of those things that's hard for people to talk about because, you know, that old saying, all politics is local, certainly feels true in education, even if it isn't strictly true. So we've been trying over the course of the time that we've been on the air to find ways to keep covering this important story, even from a national perspective. And the best, I think, best way it works is when you bring the local and the national together. And that's what we hope to do with our special broadcast from WLRN tomorrow, where we will have national policy figures talking about this issue. We will have the benefit of people who've been tweeting from all over the country about this issue, and we'll have important local figures and students participating in our conversation. So we're really excited about it.
So tell me more about the State Impact Florida component of tomorrow's program.
Well, they've been a significant part of this project from, you know, all along. In fact, in today's program, we will have kind of a download from one of the State Impact reporters. He's going to tell us about some of the stories that he's been following. One of the things that he has said and that other people have said is that Florida is, I don't know how you feel about this phrase, is kind of a petri dish for education reform, is that all the kinds of things that people are experimenting with, talking about, attempting, are being played out somewhere in Florida. You have, as you know, rural school districts, you've got urban school districts, you've got a lot of a population on the move, you've got people coming from all over the world who are studying, kids studying in Florida from, you know, all over the country, all over the world, bringing all the stuff that they bring, you know, with them. And people are trying things. People take it very seriously. And so he's going to give us a download on what he's talking about and thinking about today, just some of the things. And then tomorrow we'll also have support from one of the other State Impact reporters is going to be fielding a lot of the tweets that have been coming in to give us a sense of what it is that people are talking about, even as we are on the air. So a lot of involvement and a lot of support there, and we're very grateful for it.
Tell me, Michelle Martin, host of Tell Me More, how did the recent Chicago teacher strike shape the format? Did it have any impact?
No, not really, because a lot of the issues that were at the heart of the strike are things that have been issues not just in Chicago, but nationally, the whole question of teacher evaluations, and also just the conditions in the classroom. So those are things that just seem to have come to a head in a particularly dramatic way in the Chicago area. But those are things that we've been talking about all along, and certainly that the State Impact reporters have been covering all along.
Here in Florida, we've been very much engrossed in the charter movement. How about the future of public education in light of the charter movement? Where's it going? And what about accountability also?
Well, you know, that has been one of the things that we've been covering here also on a national level. So we're excited to have the opportunity to kind of get a close look from the Florida perspective, from a state that is as diverse as it is. We're based in Washington, D.C., which is also one of the kind of ground zero points for the charter school movement. You know, in the Washington, D.C. area, something like 40% of students go to public charter schools, and the rest go to traditional public schools. And of course, there's a lot of, there are a lot of private schools in the Washington, D.C. area, as you might imagine, given that there's a lot of, you know, wealth in this area as well. I mean, the president's children, for example, go to a private school, so private independent school. So we've got on the program not only the superintendent of the Miami-Dade school system, we also have Michelle Rhee, who was the former chancellor of the D.C. public schools, who is now very involved in advocacy work. She was the chancellor of a traditional public school district, and she has a lot to say about the role that she thinks charters play, both positively and negatively, in bringing accountability to the traditional part of public schools.
And she and Alberto Carvalho have very divergent points of view on how
they
to best resurrect a school system.
That's true. And we also have a person who was the Assistant Secretary of Education under George H.W. Bush, former President Bush, Bush 1, as some say, Diane Ravitch, who has changed her mind about some of these issues. Initially, she was a strong supporter of strict testing standards and the expansion of charter schools, and she's now changed her mind. And how often does that happen? So we're excited to have the opportunity to talk with her to find out exactly what has caused her to change her thinking about some of these issues that she once felt very strongly about and now feels equally strongly in a different direction. I think people will really be interested in to hear what she has to say.
Touch on Michelle Martin a little bit more about accountability for charters. There seems to be a lot of leeway where funds could be diverted into some rather skeptical areas without accountability.
Well, that's one of the ongoing questions about the charter school movement. On the one hand, why are people attracted to it? They're attracted to it because they feel that, you know, teachers are attracted to it, administrators are attracted to it, parents are attracted to them because they feel that the flexibility will yield better results. They think that, you know, people, one of the things you hear a lot in education is we got to move away from this one-size-fits-all approach to education. And so many people feel that charters offer that flexibility. On the other hand, because they offer a release from some of the rules that are applied to the traditional public schools, many people wonder, are you skimming off the best students? Are you finding ways to kick out kids who aren't going to meet your standard to make your numbers look better than they would otherwise? I mean, the rules vary from place to place, and in most places, the charter schools, you know, have to meet the same testing standards, but the way they get there is not subject to the same rules and regulations as the traditional public schools have to follow. So there's a wide variation in how people view these schools and the way they operate in different places across the country. And again, this has been something that we've been covering all along on this program, and we will touch on it in our broadcast tomorrow. As you know, I mean, you know, we only have an hour, and you know how quickly an hour goes by. We're going to do the best we can to both give you some breadth, but also give you some depth. And, you know, we'll do the best we can. But as I said, this is one of the subjects that we care a lot about on this program, and this is not going to be the only time in the last time that we talk about these things.
We're visiting with Michelle Martin. She's the host of Tell Me More from National Public Radio. And again, tomorrow morning at 11, we'll hear a special production of the program here on WLRN, and it will be originating from our studios. It's a national broadcast. So, Michelle, this program is going to revolve around Twitter and social media. How so?
Well, I don't know that I would say revolve around it, because at the end of the day, you know, just like your program is about ideas, you know, we're trying to bring you ideas in the best possible way, the most efficient way, and still give you enough to chew on so that you feel you got something of value. We've been using Twitter to engage with people who we otherwise would never be able to meet. I mean, for the last couple of weeks, we've been putting it out there. We're heading to Florida. This is what we're talking about. Do you want to weigh in? What's your idea? We've been asking a question, which I think, you know, Twitter lends itself to focused commentary. So we've been asking the specific question, is your school broken? That's kind of where we're launching the conversation. We're getting a wide range of opinions. And I'm happy to tell you that the answer is not uniformly no. You know, many people say, no, my school is absolutely not broken. And this is what I'd like to change. This is what I like about it. So you're getting a very broad mix of reactions to the question, which I really appreciate. One of the other things that's been interesting for us is that there are a lot of Twitter conversations already going on around education that we didn't have any knowledge of until we kind of waded into that pond ourselves. For example, there's a group of educators who meet, I've got air quotes going there, every Saturday morning to have a conversation strictly on education. They're from all over the world. We had no idea until we waded into that water ourselves. So it's a lot of exciting stuff going on with social media. Just one other point I'd make about that is that that's one of the other conversations that has been very vigorous, is what role should social media itself play in education? It's a really interesting question, because you can easily see where
it could be a two-edged sword, too.
Absolutely. You could see where it could be a huge just waste of time talking about, you know, what the latest shows on, you know, HBO or whatever. You could easily see where that could just go way wrong. On the other hand, a lot of educators are saying, you know, you got to meet students where they are anyway. These are the tools of the future. How can we harness these for the benefit of students and for ourselves to kind of share information about best practices? It's a really interesting time.
Well, Michelle Martin, it'll be a great pleasure to meet you. Of course, your program from NPR, Tell Me More, will originate from WLRN tomorrow morning at 11. And some of your crew are already here, and they look very bright-eyed and willing to work. And we'll be looking forward to meeting you, Michelle.
I'm relieved to hear it. I'm looking forward to meeting you also. Thank you for your hospitality.
My pleasure. Again, 11 a.m. Wednesday for Tell Me More. We'll be back with more.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. We're funded by listeners like you and by Life Policy Payout Program. With the program, you or someone you know can dispose of an unwanted or unneeded life insurance policy for a lump sum payment. Qualifications and more details at lifepolicypayout.com.
We'd like to thank our corporate underwriters, Bechtel Jewelers, Cleveland Orchestra, and Nacional Funeral Homes. These corporate underwriters help bring you the programs you enjoy throughout the year. Please join WLRN in thanking them for their continued support.
Like Topical Currents' Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with co-host Bonnie Berman. Welcome back. A little vacation, Bonnie.
Thank you. Thank you. Pleasure to be back.
Well, today we visit with poet, actor, and writer Carlos Andres Gomez. We'll hear the story about his one-man show and life story, as recounted in the book Man Up, Cracking the Code of Modern Manhood. Welcome to you, Carlos Andres Gomez. Good to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Welcome.
Give us an overview of your childhood, which is what began all this book and your search for being a man. Son of a white American mother and Colombian father, and he was a UN diplomat of sorts.
That's right.
Give us a thumbnail of that.
Yeah, I had a really crazy upbringing. I lived all over the world. My mom's a linguist. My dad worked for the UN. And I lived in Cyprus, Switzerland, Brazil, the U.S. I went to every kind of school you can imagine, from multiple international schools to inner city public school, Quaker school, and a Catholic school for 3 days before I got kicked out. So I think going through all these different environments and constantly being the new kid, I learned a lot to listen and be this observer kind of on the fringe. And I think that served me really well, you know, when it came to this book as a writer and also as an artist, because I know what it's like to kind of be a little bit on the outside and to be in all these different environments and see.
So you were sort of an army brat, but also you described that you were a brat brat.
Yeah, I was. I like to say I was a UN brat, but I was definitely also a brat brat. I was hell on wheels for my poor parents growing up. I was, as my mom says, I had a lot of energy, but I did have some behavior problems.
Now, did you have siblings?
Yes, I had an older sister who's 3.5 years older than me. And then after my parents were divorced, my father remarried, and I have a twin little brother and sister now.
Oh, okay.
They're younger than me.
So when and why did you begin this journey to redefine what it meant to be a man? Because you're awfully young.
Yes. And it's something that I've been grappling with for quite a few years now, and I realize it's something that's been happening my whole life. A lot of my childhood, I felt inadequate a lot, because I felt like there were so many things that were inherent about who I was that didn't allow me to become what I had been told I had to become, which was a man. I was really sensitive and creative. I was kind of a vulnerable, really raw, emotional kid, and also an affectionate kid. And every time I would express these different things, a lot of times people would say, gosh, you know, what are you doing? Man up. What are you, a little baby? What are you, a little boy? I'd be like 5 years old. I'd be like, yeah. So I think I struggled with that a lot, you know, over the course of my whole childhood. And then it wasn't until I turned 25, 5 years ago, and there was, with my art, with my writing, with my poetry, I started to really explore why I'd felt so inadequate and why I realized there were so many other men who had felt similar pressures and expectations they struggled with, and how we could shift things and change that.
A lot of this book deals with your evolving views of women. And I know early on you were very much influenced by hip-hop and that mentality. Was that part of it, of treating women with sort of disdain and just as being sort of vehicles for your outlets?
Yeah, well, I think it wasn't so much hip-hop. I think it's, you know, I think a lot of times people will say, you know, hip-hop is very degrading to women. I think it wasn't even about hip-hop. It was about the greater society at large. All these different male role models that I looked up to, whether it was that were celebrities, that were musicians, outside of hip-hop, hip-hop, rock, whatever kind of genre you want to talk about, it was very degrading to women, and especially when I was coming of age, when I was 14 or 15, and you see these guys who are getting all the kind of attention that you want, whether it's the star on the basketball team or a guy on TV. A lot of times those weren't the best role models when it came to how to interact with women.
But you dabbled in thuggery a little bit, right?
Yeah, no, I think definitely. I think when I was growing up, I was definitely a kid who didn't shy away from conflict, and, you know, who has, you know, definitely had some behavior problems. But I think so much of that was just me trying to find my identity and find my voice. And I think until I realized the kind of power that exists in embracing your vulnerability and your emotional life, I think you latch onto the, you know, the easiest thing that's there, which is the guy who's yelling the loudest, who's banging his chest with his shirt off outside of the nightclub at 3 a.m. and that's the guy that I think not just me but a lot of guys are drawn to. And I think so much of this book is about changing the conversation and changing the way that people can be men and saying, listen, this is another model, and in fact this is the most powerful model of how to be a man, and it's actually very opposite from a lot of the things we've been taught.
You mentioned role models. Why do you feel there's such a shortage of male role models today?
Well, I think you look around, and I think that there are all these contradictions that were fed as boys, right? I mean, there's so many things about this outdated model of what it means to be a man that we always hear about, right? So what does it mean to be a man? You have to be strong. You have to be capable. You have to be a provider. And I think what happens is a lot of these models are breaking down now, especially in light of the recession, where you have the highest unemployment we've seen since the Depression. And there's so many men who aren't able to be the provider because there just aren't jobs available, as much as they're trying, as much as they're sending out right. job applications. And I think that's challenging the identity that we've clung to for so long. And I think what I'm trying to do is say this is actually a really great opportunity, because there's so many men who are in really desperate situations, whether it's because of unemployment or going to war and, you know, being abroad for so long and trying to transition coming back, or, I mean, the exploding rates of incarceration that continue to rise. I mean, all these different things are taking away men in their prime years, away from their families, away from their kids. And so what's left? You've got reality TV, you've got these guys that kids like me when I was 14 or 15 look up to and say, oh, I want to be that dude on the Jersey Shore. I want to be that guy, you know, who's performing at the Grammys, you know, who's drunk on stage, you know.
We had a guest on about a month or two ago who said that today's environment, that women really have a bigger advantage than men. They're more highly educated, they're more adaptive, and men are kind of having difficulties getting a career started.
Exactly. Yeah.
Was this Hannah Rosen?
Yes. I was just going to say.
It was
called The End of Men.
Absolutely.
That was her book.
She moderated a panel I was on at the Brooklyn Book Festival a couple weekends back, and that we were talking for a while.
I forget these names.
Oh, interesting. But
yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. We talked a lot. We've corresponded back and forth. Yeah. I think it makes a really powerful point. I know there's incredible controversy and a wide array of perspectives on her book and even her theory.
Right.
But I think that the one thing that I actually connect with, that resonates very strongly with me, is this idea that the model of what it means to be a man is just simply obsolete. And I actually agree with that. I think that the model that so many of us guys cling to, which is this guy who's, you know, strong, capable, not emotional, never weak, never asks for help, always the provider, always in control. It's a completely unrealistic model because no human being is that.
So who do you feel? Do you feel there are any positive role models in the world today men?
Oh, no, absolutely. I think there are many.
Would you care to share some?
I think there are an incredible amount of role models. I think one thing that I always emphasize is, you know, people always say, so give me like your five best role models of the kind of men everyone should be. But here's something where I'm kind of flipping it up. I think that the greatest role models we have, a lot of them are ones that never get the big exposure on TV. You know, like I think my father's an amazing role model. You know, that's not going to be your model or your model Joe, you know, but I think there's so many, or my one of my best friends from college, you know, his dad's worked for the Postal Service for 35 years. You know, he writes poems, he's incredibly affectionate, he says what he means, he's a great communicator, he's humble. He acknowledges his emotional life. You know, that's a hero right there. And so I think a big emphasis I always give is, you know, the most powerful role models we can have are ones we can talk to, we can touch, we can hug, we can ask questions to, because I can't ask questions to Pauly D on Jersey Shore, but I can ask questions to my dad.
Charles Barkley had that going years ago of saying, I shouldn't be
I'm not a role model.
The parents should be the role models, not me, just because I play in the NBA and make millions.
Absolutely. This is one of the things. I used to live in Bed-Stuy in Brooklyn, and I'd always hear so much people say, oh my gosh, Bed-Stuy. And I didn't live in a part that was gentrified, and people would say, wow, you know, it must be so dangerous in Bed-Stuy and crazy stuff happens, you know, and there's so many people who are violent in Bed-Stuy and whatever else. And I'd say, I love it that, you know, two or three guys who are in a difficult time in their lives trying to find themselves, not to justify it, but they're going through whatever they're going through, and they may carry a gun, someone might get shot. They represent the hundreds of other people who are working class and who are good fathers and who are good parents who aren't making that much noise. So I think there's a big emphasis for me on saying, listen, look around, look at the guy next to you, look at the people who you work with that you think are powerful role models, and let's put those people on pedestals, and let's tell our young people, you know what, look up to that guy, look up to your coach, look up to your uncle, look up to your older brother, because he's an amazing role model. So
our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, you're certainly welcome. We're visiting with writer, poet, and actor Carlos Andres Gomez. Our number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, and also email, that's radio@WLRN.org. Bonnie, how about some word about Carlos's appearance at Books and Books?
Yes, tonight? Carlos will be at Books and Books in Coral Gables tonight at 8 p.m. That's at 265 Aragon Avenue. And you might want to go out and get the book and meet Carlos.
Now you're a performer. What kind of event can people expect from you?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, it might be a different kind of book event than you're used to. I'm a performer and a writer, so
you do one man programs.
Absolutely, absolutely. I like a very interactive, high energy experience. It's going to be, think of it like a show and with a discussion following it. So I'm going to perform. I'm going to tell stories. There's going to be a Q&A, and whoever comes. You know, I'm very interactive, so I meet the people afterwards and talk to them, and I'm very much about being in the moment, seeing what's happening, and having a celebration together. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
I can attest to that. What does the word strength mean to you today?
Wow, the word strength. I think the word strength for me means being accountable, being vulnerable, and being present. Those are the first three words that came to mind. It might be different tomorrow, but that's what it is right now.
Okay, being accountable, being present, and what was the other?
And being vulnerable.
And being vulnerable.
Yes, I think that there's one of the biggest conspiracies against both men and women, but I think it's more so men, because I feel like there's a whole emotional range that women, because of gender binaries, they've been enabled to embrace more so than men. But this idea that vulnerability is weakness, and I think that that's absolutely not true. I remember I was 23 years old and I was in an acting class, and I'd always been a very, very sensitive, emotional kid, and I was so ashamed of it. It was the thing that I spent most of my life managing and trying to hide.
Right.
And Joe, like you mentioned, like, you know, like the thuggery or the misbehavior late in childhood that I struggled with. Anytime I'd get emotional, I'd act out, right? I'd punch the door, I'd yell at someone, I'd reach for anger, you know, that secondary emotion that covers up all the really good stuff. And I was 23 years old in acting class, and I got really emotional, and I was more humiliated than I'd ever been in my life. And I'm wiping away the tears, and I'm apologizing, and my teacher said to me, he said, "Why are you apologizing?" He said, "You're wiping away your talent. That's where all your gifts live, is right in that place where you are right now. Never fear that place and never apologize for it."
A big part of your book deals with the homophobia and that you exhibited some of that early on, to be one of the guys, to be the tough guy,
yeah,
using the words that are so hurtful. How did you evolve into having a more enlightened view?
Well, I think, I mean, the big thing about this entire book is it's all about growth. And I think, I laugh sometimes because I think the book is shelved, you know, with self-improvement or self-help. And when I think of that, I always think of a guy with perfectly bleached teeth and his, you know, creased khakis walking back and forth completely in control in this book that's very sterile and clean and nobody can relate to. Sorry, no offense to any self-help authors, but that's just my impression, I guess. And this book is very raw and gritty, and it's all about the journey. It's all about growth. And you'll find that I'm not somebody who's this righteous, I'm not better than anybody I'm talking about. In fact, you'll be like, God, this guy Carlos, man, he's a gritty dude. He's made a lot of mistakes. He's done good things. He's done bad things. But he's somebody that I can relate to. And I feel like that's the kind of role model that I always wanted to look up to, was somebody that I could relate to. And I think it's all about the journey of growing through all those things. And I think I was lucky to have great role models that showed me that doing these things, whether it was being homophobic or degrading the women, that's not really what it's about to be a man. And in fact, to really be a man, I think it should mean the opposite.
I'd like to ask you about love, but we need to take a short break.
Sure.
Okay, sounds we're speaking good. With actor, poet, and writer Carlos Andres Gomez, and it's today's Topical Currents. We will be right back. Please continue to call if you're interested in speaking to him, or emailing. It's radio@wlrn.org.
This is Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station, and 91.5 WKWM NPR for the Florida Keys. Shakespeare is made contemporary in a 60-minute adaptation of Macbeth, performed with shadow interpretation by the acclaimed Oslo Theater, Repertory Theater, at the South Miami-Dade Cultural Arts Center, October 12th at 8 p.m. Details at smdcac.org or 786-573-5300.
This month, President Barack Obama and Mitt Romney take part in the final presidential debate at Lynn University in Boca Raton. What are the issues that matter to you? We'll find out Friday, October 19th, when the Florida Roundup broadcasts live from Lynn University in advance of the debate. I'm Phil Latzman. Join me along with NPR's political junkie, Ken Rudin, and Florida lawmakers and top political journalists. Reserve your seat now for the Florida Roundup presidential debate special, Friday, October 19th at noon, and find out more at WLRN.org.
And we do return. 34 minutes past 1 o'clock. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman, and we resume our conversation with poet, actor, and writer Carlos Andres Gomez. Tell me, Carlo, you've been around, you've worked as a social worker and teacher, and you've been in some pretty hardcore situations, and I was kind of interested in maybe you could briefly recount this business in the brothel where you were nearly shot to death.
Wow. Yeah, I used to work in Morrisania and Highbridge in the South Bronx and in Central Harlem, and I had a lot of more than a few close calls.
Doesn't get any more real than that.
And there's one story that I talk about. It's actually in the forgiveness chapter. The book's broken down into themes, and I talk about, you know, forgiveness, love, conflict, vulnerability, all these different things. And there was a place that a brothel that I would go once a week, and I drop off condoms and I drop off information packets. And there was a miscommunication that happened between one of the men who was, I guess, a client, you could say, of the brothel.
The John.
and the madam behind the counter, there was a language barrier. She spoke Spanish and he spoke English. And still not clear if it was an honest miscommunication or if something happened. The pimp, basically, after he was there was an argument between the madam and the John, they had a confrontation, and the guy pulled a gun. The John pulled a gun, and the story that I tell in the book is, there are a couple situations I talk about where I felt like my body acted completely without my permission, because this was not a choice that I felt like I was making, and I don't even remember actually really seeing the gun. I just remember I was sitting there, and I was very much resolute that I would not get involved in the confrontation. And before I knew it, I'd wrapped up the John with both arms, and his friend was had wrapped me up, and the three of us kind of stumbled into the stairwell, all wrestling each other while he tried to pull his gun above his waist. And in the story, I talk about how I got out of that situation, which was one of the more surprising and incredible moments of my life and one of the most poignant lessons I had about forgiveness. But you got to read the book to find out.
You don't want to tell us a little more?
Well, I will tell you I didn't get shot, and I'm still alive. But
yes.
But you got to read the book to find out.
Okay. All right.
How have your relationships with women changed over the years and since you began this began writing poetry?
Absolutely. Well, it's changed a lot. I think a big part of my identity for so much of my life was being an athlete and being a basketball player. And I wanted to be Michael Jordan from the time I was 7 years old on. And then if I couldn't be Michael Jordan, I at least wanted to be a basketball star and have everything that came along with that. You know, I wanted a Ferrari and women and fame. but then you grow up and you mature. And when I was 17, I discovered poetry, and my whole life had said I wasn't an artist. I didn't like to write. I struggled learning how to read for when I was younger. So I never had a reason to really like poetry. And it was kind of against all odds that this poet came to my high school named Martin Espada. And I'd never felt so moved in my life. And much to my dismay, his poetry made me feel in a way that I had no control over. I just sat in the corner and held my hand over my face, pretending like I was having an allergic reaction while tears poured down my cheeks, and I listened to his poems, and I realized I wanted to write poetry. And it was my gateway that gave me permission to embrace all these different parts of myself that for 17 years up to that point I'd never been given permission to embrace.
Yeah.
Could you maybe give us a little example of some of your poetry, short, maybe off the top of your head? I know you're putting I'm putting wow. you on the spot,
but yeah,
I like to do that.
So. No, I love it. I love it. I'll give you a short little snippet. And this is a little opening piece of a poem I wrote about asking a woman to dance in a nightclub, and it's called Hector Lavoe is God. I just might get her to stand up, but for now she's moving in her seat, playing it cool while I flirt, tease the timbales into my hips. It's a Saturday night in Northeast Philly, but she and I might as well be at the Colosseum in Rome. Julius Caesar watching with a smirk, drunk on my bravado, and she's still sitting. But that doesn't mean we ain't dancing. Doesn't mean we ain't pulsing at the center of this dance floor like a swollen heart about to flood itself inside out, my eyes closed, sweat soaked, the bass guitar and clave. She spins me. She spins me around her.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Beautiful. I loved your poetry in the book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. What does love mean to you today?
You know, it's amazing. I had this conversation recently with my best friend, and we were talking about our evolving ideas about what it means to be in love and what the word love means. And the closest I've come at this point in my evolution of what love means, I think it means a lot of things. You can ask me tomorrow and I might say something different. But I think it means two people giving each other full permission to be the best they could ever be. That's what love is for me. But it's also freedom, it's also commitment, and it's giving, and it's presentness, and it's a purpose that is greater than anything else I know of.
Do you have love in your life today?
Yes, I feel very, very thankful. I talk about it in the book. I'm very blessed and very grateful to have an amazing, amazing person in my life. My fiance, who is talked about in the book, she was my girlfriend at the time, who I probably against huge odds, probably maybe shouldn't still be with me after all that we went through, but she's still with me, and she. She's one of the biggest reasons I think I even dared to try to write this book or embarked on this journey to try to redefine what it could mean to be a man and really embrace this conversation. I think she really pushed me to be a much better man than I ever had any reason to think I could be.
Mm.
And hopefully I also make her better too, but I know she makes me a lot better.
We have a caller here who's suggesting, well, I'll put him on here.
Yeah, yeah.
Brian in Hollywood. Hi.
Hey, Brian.
Oh, hi. Yes, this is Brian. Listen, yeah, Carlos, don't accept that we, this is a comment.
Yeah.
I don't accept that we need to, you know, change our, what's been, you know, programmed into us as masculinity.
Yeah.
And femininity. I think we celebrate our masculinity and our femininity. You know, Bruce Springsteen is a poet, and I don't think you can find anybody say he's not, you know, a model for masculinity. But, you know, this, I mean, there's a limit, because if a woman is feminine as to what she can do. Margaret Thatcher was the Iron Lady.
Yeah.
We can't morph the two. Women want men to be, and this is in general terms. There's exceptions, and we have to respect that. But in general terms, women want men to be masculine, and men want women to be masculine. We can't morph the two genders into some kind of androgynous, you know, being or behavior. It's just nobody would want that. So, you know, you sound like a very masculine, manly man kind of guy to me, and you're a poet, and that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
So, but I don't buy your assumption that there is a problem, or that we need to change, you know, the way men are programmed as men, the way women are programmed as women. That's not going to go away. When you have kids, and I don't mean to be getting out of soapbox, but you watch the girls from a very early age, you know, they act like girls, and the boy, and there are exceptions, of course, and we have to respect that. Let me say that again. But, and then the boys, they go off and act like boys.
Tell the fingernail
polish
story.
Anyway, that's my comment.
The what?
The fingernail polish story.
Absolutely. Sure. Well. Brian, thank you so much. I really appreciate your comment. That was perfect. It couldn't have been any more better scripted. Well, first of all, I'd love to say, I think people get really nervous whenever you talk about any sort of cultural shift or change, and I totally respect that. Obviously, everyone wants everything to stay the same. That's why the status quo is the status quo. And I think anytime I talk about shifting what it means to be a man, everyone says, oh my gosh, you want everyone to be the same. You want everyone to be a certain thing. And I think, no, that's absolutely not what I'm saying at all. I think what I'm really saying is, I want people to have permission to live outside of a narrow and suffocating box. Do I know that there is a narrow suffocating box? Yes, because I've lived in it for a lot of my life. Do I think that people enjoy living in it? I know for a fact that people don't. As a social worker, as a teacher, as a mentor, as a counselor, as a man, as a brother, as a friend, as a son, I've lost so many men, whether it's to addiction or to incarceration or to suicide or to a wide range of things, because they felt like there were parts of themselves that they were not allowed to be and that they could never show to the world. Whether it was their sexuality, whether it was their poetry, whether it was some other aspect of themselves, their vulnerability, their emotion. And so I think it's one of those things where I appreciate your comment, Brian, and I totally hear you, and I actually agree with what you're saying in the sense that, you know, my mom's an anthropologist, and she talks a lot about this is what culture is. It's an agreement that we all make together, but culture shifts and changes. And I would even go as far to say that, you know what, not only is it not impossible for this to change, it is changing. There are so many men already who are stay-at-home dads, who are blurring the lines of what a man is supposed to do. And I think a lot of it is changing. Something that Joe had asked me to tell her quick story. Right. And I love that you brought up having kids, which I don't have any kids. But when I was a kid, I remember something that was a story I talk about in the book is when I was 6 years old and I'm in Colombia visiting my family. And my sister and my aunt are getting their nails painted. I'm 6 years old. I say, oh, wow, the nails are beautiful. I want beautiful nails too. And so I keep asking, I want my nails painted. Like, no, that's only for girls. And I was upset. I said, I want pretty nails too. So I keep hassling my tia, my aunt, and she finally paints my nails. And I'm so proud, I want to show the whole world. So I go running out into the courtyard, and there's a soccer game breaking out. And this is actually when I was in Colombia, right? So I go to the soccer game, I'm dancing around, and I'm so excited. And I'm playing soccer with everyone, and one of the older kids grabs my hand, and he says, you can't play. And he says, little, and fill in the blank, he says, cannot play. And it was a very disparaging word for someone that would be gay. And I didn't even know what the word meant, but I knew by the reaction everyone had to it, the power of that word. And it was one of the most shameful moments I encountered. It was one of the first gendered times where I realized the price of having to be one thing and not being able to be anything else. And so when I went inside and I remember my aunt was taking off the nail polish, she said, you know, I tried to tell you, Carlos Andres, I tried to tell you, but you didn't learn. Now you know why there are certain things little boys cannot do. And I want people to feel the freedom to be all they can be. And however people identify me, you're a man, right? You talk like a man, like you just, you know, like Brian just said, you know, you sound like a man. You sound like a guy. People see me walk around, they see my build, they say, well, but you look like a guy. Yeah, sure. I'm not telling you can't be anything or you have to be anything. I want you to feel freedom to be whatever you want to be. And that's really what this is about. It's not making everyone the same. It's not telling everyone what they have to be. It's more about taking those chains off, breaking the walls down, and letting people embrace a lot more.
Did you feel like you had to write this book? Was it something that you...
Absolutely. That comment was perfect. What Brian said was so perfect. I think that overwhelmingly, too, I feel like there are even men who I know... I felt like there was a gun in my head writing this book, to be honest with you. I felt like there was so much at stake because of people I'd worked with, from 13-year-old heroin addicts I'd been a counselor to 16-year-olds who were, you know, incarcerated for murder. And I mean, these are kids who were literally saying, you know what, like, I was called the sissy in the neighborhood, so I had to let everyone know I was a man. This is a kid that was 14 or 15 saying this. So I had to let everyone know. I'm like, you're not a man. You're a kid. You're not a man. And I felt like, and what's amazing too is the double speak you'll hear, right? You'll hear someone say, you know, I want to be a man. I am a man. I'm all these things. And then candidly, they'll talk to you and tell you about how high the price is of having to fit within this thing that they are not. And so really what this is about is, you know, is people knowing that there's more than one way you can be a guy, and it's cool. And when you really get candid and have an honest conversation with another guy, you'll hear that we have been blurring these lines. But if no one's talking about it, we think we're the only ones who are doing it. Right. And so much of this book is about that growth, and also about showing how messy this journey is, and it's okay, and you're not alone.
Do you feel like the book, writing the book, transformed you?
Absolutely. I'm definitely a different person than I was when I started. From the play to the book, the thing I tell my partner, Whitney, I say, you know, the play was when I went through and wrote the play, which inspired the book, but the book is very different than the play. That was the first time I realized I had lost the woman of my life, and I was pretty sure I'd never get her back, but I was going to try, and I did get her back. And that was the first time we entered into a committed relationship. And then when I wrote this book, she wanted to be married forever. And two months after I handed in the final finished draft of the book, we got engaged. So it's a full journey there.
Wow.
Yeah, with that. Yeah, definitely different.
Let's take another call or two. Next up, we have Janet calling from South Miami. Thanks for your patience, Janet. Hi.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Carlos Andres, for being on the show. Just out of curiosity, I have two nephews, 15 years old. I'm wondering if this would be appropriate, something for them to read. Because I hear some of the things you're saying, and I see so many other kids at their age struggling through that, and they also come from a split family, or I guess a broken family, or whatever term you want to use.
That might be debatable, right, Carlos?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I kind of
there's some
it
sexual
up,
situations in there.
Yeah,
exactly.
No, yeah.
You know, just out of, you know, curiosity, because it sounds like something that maybe they could possibly learn from. Maybe not. Some things they might not want to learn.
No. I'm really glad thank you for your call. I think my suggestion, the suggestion I'm giving people is there is some graphic adult material in the book. There's nothing gratuitous, in my opinion. I mean, I used to work as a social worker in Harlem, the Bronx. So my standards might be different than other people's. I would say buy the book for yourself. You read it. And you make a decision from there. I work with 15 and 16-year-old kids that are incarcerated for very serious assault charges. And I know I've talked to parents of some kids, and they say, yeah, this book is definitely fine for them. But there are other people where they say, no, the book is maybe wouldn't be appropriate for someone under 18. But I think 16 to 18, 15 to 18 is kind of that depending on what you think. So I would say you get the book and you read it, and maybe you could either have part of it that you may share with them, or maybe you might decide to get the book for both nephews.
A quick reminder for our listeners, poet, actor, and writer Carlos Andres Gomez will be at Books and Books tonight. That's at 8:00 at the Coral Gables store. That's on Aragon Avenue. Again, Books and Books, 8 p.m. Carlos Andres Gomez. I'm sure you're going to have a good time. He's a
It sounds like it's going to be a
sorts.
Yeah.
So with all the things you've done, the myriad of things that you've done, how does this book fit in? Is it one of your most rewarding experiences?
This book is by far the most thrilling, frightening, cathartic, and freeing thing I've ever done. Nothing even comes close, I think. I've done, you know, a lot of stuff as an actor, as a writer, as a performer, but nothing even compares to this, because there's nothing that I've ever done that's this revealing or this much of a commitment of just jumping in with my full body. But it's been, but like I said, it's also been a really cathartic and freeing thing. So I'm so glad that I did.
Tell us briefly the saga of you and your father, Papi.
Yes.
And how you were finally reunited the way you closed the book.
Yeah. Well, I
with
think
such affection.
Yeah. I mean, I think similar to, I think a lot of boys and a lot of men out there, I had a complicated relationship with my father, and, we went through very difficult times. We went to times we were distant and some really hard times where we didn't even talk. And the book is really about coming full circle and realizing that even though you have really difficult times, there is hope on the other side of that. And there are ways to embrace forgiveness that doesn't dishonor and push aside and not demand that people are accountable for certain things. And I think it's been a really beautiful story of my father and I where, you know, we went through some really difficult times in a really difficult decade following the divorce of my parents. But right now we couldn't be closer than we are. And I feel so blessed to have him in my life. And he's gone from being somebody who I was very angry with for a long time and very distant from to literally being one of the people who I aspire to become and look up to more than anyone else. Because I say this often, I've never met anybody who's grown as much as my father has. And that's so inspiring to me.
I found it interesting that early on in your childhood, you were really very much against any form of prejudice and bigotry, and you'd fight because of it, of other people being discriminated against.
Absolutely. I think a lot of it came from my mom, who influenced me.
She's American.
Yes, she's a gringa.
A gringa.
Estadounidense. You know, but she would always say, she'd say, you know, if you ever see someone being bullied, it's your responsibility to stand up to that bully. And so bullying was my concept for all the justice related things. But something that you'll see in the book that's so messy is we all have our issues. We all have all these different complicated layers of how we've been socialized and what we've been taught in school and by our parents and by our peers. And so there are also contradictions in there. I still am very driven by respecting and loving people for who they are and fighting against prejudice. But that doesn't mean that we have prejudices ourselves that we're trying to unlearn and we're working to undo.
Have you gotten any pushback or any flack from peers about this book and about this journey that you're on? Or
you know what's really interesting is what I found really profound is there are a lot of men who have initial pushback, and then they'll pull me aside and say, "Yeah, man, I can really relate to that," which to me is evidence of how necessary and urgent the book is. Because even what Brian said, I thought it was an incredibly thoughtful comment, and I appreciate it. I can even relate to it. You know, I don't want to change anything either. I moved 12 times before I graduated high school. I hate change, you know? But just saying, you know, everything's fine. We don't need to change anything. And then reading the book and saying, gosh, yeah, I can relate to that. and I think a lot of men have come to me and said, even had really knee-jerk reactions initially. And then they've read the book or they've heard more about what I'm talking about. And they say, gosh, yeah, I really need to read that. I can relate to that. And I think that's been most, I guess, the biggest symbolic reaction to it across the board.
So are you satisfied with the man you are today?
Wow. I get this question a lot. People say, wow, how did you arrive at this man or whatever it is? And it's not really about arrival. It's not even about satisfaction. I think I'm at peace with the person that I am, but I've not arrived anywhere. I will continue to grow and continue to become and learn and make mistakes and try to do better. It's an ongoing process, and I will continue to grow until the day I die, and hopefully afterwards.
And hopefully with Whitney.
And hopefully with Whitney, exactly.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. We've been visiting with poet, actor, and writer Carlos Andres Gomez about his book, Man Up, Cracking the Code of Modern Manhood. And once again, Carlos Andres Gomez will be appearing tonight at 8 p.m. in Coral Gables at the Books and Books franchise on Aragon Avenue. Thank you, Carlos, and the best to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that wraps up today's program. Our producer is Richard Ive, technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts and Peter J. Paul Leary gives production assistance. Find free audio archives and MP3 downloads at our website. That's WLRN.org. Also, author and book links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Drop us a like so your friends can find us as well. Tomorrow at this time, it's live coverage of the Miami-Dade School Board meeting, and Thursday we begin with a look at a community-wide three-month awareness program called LIGHT, the Holocaust and Humanity Project. Also, Linda Gassenheimer's Food and Dining with our favorite wine columnist, Fred Tasker. And an all rock and roll calendar for October 9th. On this day in 1940, 72 years ago, the birth of Beatle John Lennon in Liverpool. His delivery was during a German air raid. He first met Paul McCartney in 1957. And on this day in 1965, 47 years ago, the Beatles' Yesterday tops the pop charts and stays there for a month. It's the most covered song ever recorded. One more while we get all shook up. On this day in 1974, 38 years ago, Elvis and Priscilla Presley are granted a divorce. Priscilla gains custody of daughter Lisa Marie. And we leave with this from the King, Elvis Presley, quote, "The first time I appeared on stage, it scared me to death. I really didn't know what all the yelling was about. I didn't realize that my body was moving. It's just a natural thing to me." This is Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making public radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This is 91.